Do you want to start? Oh, okay. Thank you. Didn't know if I was jumping roles here. We are continuing near the end of this series, Answers in April. It's a series of biblical answers to questions that are very common, commonly asked. Why do Christians believe what we believe? Why should we believe what we believe? And it's been a rich series so far, and hopefully we'll continue that this evening. If you are a guest here, we very much are glad you're here and welcome your questions. And I'll be glad to talk with you more, as will any number of the men who have presented thoughts this month. But let's begin with a prayer together. Our good Father, you have given us another wonderful day full of your richness of blessing and providence, and we thank you for it. And here near the evening, we are glad to be together to share this time in common thought and common study, reflecting on you and the world you created and what that tells us about you. We thank you for your grace. We thank you for your word, which lets us know who you are, what your will is, what your heart is. And we pray that we'll be more submissive to you as we deepen our understanding of your character and your nature. In Jesus' name, amen. As Buddy pointed out Sunday in the class time, some of these classes are a little bit unusual and there's less Bible in them. We believe very much in firm biblical teaching, that the doctrines we teach and the applications we make have clear connections to Scripture, so that we know it's what God is teaching. This kind of a lesson speaks from God's other revelation, which the Bible refers to as creation, which also speaks to Him. You can't know God's will from nature, but you can know His nature, that He is divine, that He exists. And we took a look Sunday at the cosmos, at the macro scale of creation. And Buddy walked us all through that. This evening, we're going to go the opposite extreme. It's become my firm belief that the world is created in such a way that as far as we can look out and as deep as we can look in and small, it simply never ends. There's layer upon layer upon layer of complexity and design in it. And as soon as we think we have something figured out, a world opens up and there's depth that we never knew existed. There's questions to answer that we never even knew to ask. And we're going to take a look at some of that this evening and historically how that simplicity has played out to be much more complex. God is in sight. God is in sight. He's in sight because He's made Himself known. And He's in sight in sight. Everybody talks about vision. When you talk about evolution and creation, everybody talks about vision, including Darwin. I'm going to give you a little bit of background on Charles Darwin. Today and Sunday, going to give you a little bit of background just on what evolution really is, as we also discuss on ideas of where it has gone awry, why it's gone awry. Charles Darwin was born in 1809, son of a physician, a fairly wealthy family. He grew up, his father sent him to medical school. He didn't like the lectures. He really didn't like the surgery experiences. Surgery in early 1800s, pretty brutal stuff. And that just wasn't Darwin's stomach. And he didn't study well. And so his dad shipped him off to seminary. He didn't like that really either. He just didn't like school. He liked animals. And he liked nature. And he liked geology. And he played around outside a lot. But not just playing around. He was learning things. Just not what his classes and professors were always trying to teach him. And that led him to have a very developed knowledge of nature. And so in 1831, one of his professors got him a position on a boat, a fateful position called the HMS Beagle. And the voyage of the Beagle was to circumnavigate South America and chart the map for England. Ended up going all over the globe. For 5 years, Darwin traveled as a naturalist on the Beagle. He had learned taxidermy at an early age, and so he collected samples, he preserved them, he shipped them back from time to time, took copious notes and all kinds of data, and eventually got back home to England. And along the way, he saw lots and lots of things. And that all those things turned ideas in his mind. And for years, he turned them over and discussed them and thought about them. And in the 1850s, he realized there was another scientist who was about to publish a paper stating the very ideas Darwin had been mulling over for all these years. And if you're a scientist, you want to publish first. Because if someone else publishes first, you're just that guy. But if you publish first, you're that guy. And so Darwin talked to his colleague, and they co-published a paper with Darwin having first billing on it. You can see their names here, by Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace, on the tendency of species to form varieties and on the perpetuation of varieties and species by natural means of selection. And that's his paper published in this journal, Proceedings of the Linnaean Society, which is an international honor society for scientists. And that put Darwin on the map. He published in the journal. Later, he published his book on the origin of species, published in 1859. The next year is when he published his book. Sold out the first day, and the world has never been the same. The ideas of Charles Darwin are unquestionably one of the most influential and powerful ideas of the last 150 years, without question. They have influenced not just biology, but law and psychology and all of sociology and philosophy. It is absolutely dominant. I got to attend a dinner when I was a student working in Gainesville, after I was a student in Gainesville. And a buddy was there that night. I remember being there for that dinner on the campus of the University of Florida. And the guest speaker was from the chemistry department. And for a chemist, he was a surprisingly good speaker. Chris and Philip and just kidding. But he was a really good speaker. And his talk was, what is the unifying thought of natural science? What is it that holds all natural science together? And that's chemistry and biology, physics, astronomy, and geology. Guess what the common thread pulling all those things together is? Darwinism. It's Darwin, evolution. On the broadest scale to the smallest scale. It is the foundational principle of all natural science. And so when you challenge that, understand to challenge Darwinism is to challenge the foundational bedrock of all natural science and most disciplines beyond that. So it is no light thing to challenge Darwinism, which is why it is met with such, in case sometimes, ferocious response to that kind of a challenge. And one of the places Darwin stopped were, let me tell you his ideas first. Just very, very simply. One, populations change over time. And everybody knows this, by the way. Populations, we'll talk a little bit more about this on Sunday. Populations change over time. And nobody questions that. And they change because of what he called natural selection. There are traits that are more fit, and those traits survive and become more common. And the traits that don't fit, those animals don't survive. At least not long enough to produce, reproduce. And those traits disappear over time. And so over time, advantageous traits develop and become common. One of the places, maybe more than any other, that really represents this are these islands off the west coast of South America, the famous Galapagos Islands. They're volcanic islands. It's an archipelago, a group of little small islands out there, came up from volcanic activity underneath the ocean. And Darwin spent a lot of time on the Galapagos, hopping around these islands. And one thing he noticed was the variety of finches. Most of us wouldn't really care. But Darwin was, if anything, an excellent observer. He was an excellent observer, which is one reason he was such a good scientist. He paid attention. And what he noticed was different niches of islands have different types of finches. They all had finches, but they're different. And you can see some of that here. Some had these really thick, robust bills on them like that. Some had little, tiny, prissy bills like that one up there. And others were in between. And there's varieties of color and that kind of stuff. And this is Darwin's thought. Did God create a finch for every little island in this archipelago? I don't want to go there. Go here. Did he create a finch for this island and then a finch for that one and a finch for that one and another one here and another one here? Is that what God did? Or did a population of finches get, because there's nothing close to these islands. Did a population of birds somehow get there, blown there by a storm? They arrive there, and over time, depending on the particular niche where that bird was, traits changed. And so some populations ended up with larger beaks, and some ended up with smaller beaks and different colorings. And he said, that makes sense. And I'll have to tell you, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. And we know that just from our own experience, don't we? Animals change. Plants change. Deer in Florida are not the same as deer in Kentucky. If you hunt, you know that. You got to kill more down here to stay alive than you do up there. They're tiny down here. They're big up there. So did God make Kentucky deer and Florida deer, or did he make deer? And for whatever reason, and I don't know the reason, it's more advantageous to be small down here and more advantageous to be bigger up there. That's almost certainly what happened. And so Darwin took that idea and then said, well, if finches can change, then if finch beaks can change, then maybe finches didn't come from a bird at all. Birds came from something else. And that came from something else. And that came from something else. So all living things have evolved from some kind of common ancestor. And that was his general theory of evolution that you and I are familiar with. And that has been a profound influence on the world. Well, in his book, Origin of Species, one of the things he discusses are challenges to his theory. And one of those challenges is the human eye. Even then, they knew the human eye was an amazingly complicated thing. And Darwin said this about it. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. That's right. But let me be fair to Darwin. The very next paragraph, he says, but it's not absurd. It seems absurd, but it's not. And he states his faith that natural selection could do it. And this is the argument. And this is still the argument made. Maybe the chief proponent of evolution in our day, in our time, is Richard Dawkins from England. He's difficult and not a very pleasant fellow. But this is his argument. And he talks about the eye in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. And this is what he says. Take a human eye. And make a perfect human eye, 20/20 vision, and make it just a little imperfect. That's most of you in this room. You can still see, right? But it's not perfect. So take that and make that a little more imperfect. And take that one and a little bit more imperfect, and just keep imperfecting it little bit. Doesn't have to be much at all. Incrementally, just make it a little less imperfect. For back and back and back. And if you do that enough times, you end up with something that's very, very simple. A cell that can detect light. And that's how vision began. Some one-celled organism developed the ability to detect light. And over the years, in incremental steps of improvement, it became the human eye. And this is how Dawkins will put it. If in your imagination it takes 1,000 steps to do that, then you can imagine that. And so it's true. If 1,000 isn't enough, and this is what he'll say, I read this again today, make it 10,000. If 10,000 steps won't do it, then make it 100,000. But if you can imagine it, that's what happened. And that's how the eye arose. And that's the explanation for human vision. What I'd like to do tonight is this. I'd like to talk about vision, but I don't want to talk about the human eye. It's pretty amazing. It's remarkable. I want to go back to the very, very beginning. Let's take a one-celled organism that has a light-sensitive spot. And I want you to see what it takes to have that. Because that's where it began. A one-celled organism had to become, in Darwin's view, and Dawkins' view, sensitive to light. And that's easy enough, right? It just has to be light-sensitive. And then you could develop the rest. Now, there's all kinds of problems, by the way, folks, with saying, just imagine 10,000 steps. Can you imagine it? Okay, that's how it happened. That's loaded with problems. But we can't get into all those problems. We're just going to go back to the very beginning. What does it take for a one-celled organism to become sensitive to light? This is the idea. And this is way beyond one cell, by the way. This is part of the argument Darwin made and Dawkins makes. A limpet, which is a very much, much, much more complex than what I'm going to talk about tonight. Far more complex. It has a light-sensitive spot with some light-sensitive cells on it and a nerve running out of it. And then there are organisms like abalone, which has a light-sensitive spot, but it's in a little cup, so it can start to tell what direction light's coming from. A limpet can't do that, but abalone can. So now you start having the advantage of not only knowing if light's around, but where's it coming from. Make that a little bit more complicated, and you have a nautilus, which is like a tiny octopus stuck in a shell, basically, is what a nautilus is. And it now has light-sensitive cells here in this sort of pinkish layer, whatever. But now it has fluid in the cavity as well. And now you can get to a marine snail, which has a simple lens in the fluid and the beginnings of sort of covering, like your cornea. And then you can have a squid, which has an eye very much like yours and mine, very complex eye, with a big old nerve coming back, a retina like you and I have, a lens and a cornea over the top and all kinds of fluid in it. And see, just step, 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 and that's how those eyes evolve. That's the argument. Now remember, this is a very, very simplistic picture. To jump from here to here is no small matter. And to jump from here to here is no small matter. So don't oversimplify that. What does it take to sense light? Before we explain it, notice this. To have an advantage, an organism first must be able to sense light versus dark. But that's not enough. It has to be able to communicate that information to itself. You can have a cell that reacts to light, but that's got to be connected to something. So that the organism knows that cell has detected light. Make sense? You got to have communication. Third, it has to integrate that information with all the other information coming in. Do you know how much stimulus your brain is receiving right now, every second? It's overwhelming. Everything visually, the smells, the sounds, the touch, the senses, just the thoughts to keep things... overwhelming information. You got to integrate all that. Otherwise, it's just a mess. It doesn't do anything. You can't communicate. You have to be able to react to the communication. So you have to know light is there. You have to be able to communicate that. And you have to be able to do something with that. Otherwise, who cares? You have to be able to swim or move or jump or high five or yell or shout or go to sleep or something. So you got to have that reaction in there. And then finally, you have to maintain all of that. You have to reset switches that have been turned on. You got to turn them off again. You got to feed them. You got to wire them. You got to keep all those components built. When they wear out, you got to tear them down, recycle them, and rebuild them. All those systems have to be in place for this to work. Got it? So I'm going to give you the tiddlywinks version of light sensitivity in bacteria cells. Fun, fascinating stuff to two of us in the room. But maybe to a few more of you. What we're going to look at is one type of cell in this group called archaea. What does archaea suggest? Old. Right, old. When they first discovered these things, they thought they were the oldest forms of life. They since decided they haven't because they're biochemically more similar to advanced organisms like over here animals and fungi and stuff than they are to bacteria. A little bit more on this on Sunday. See this tree? All these groups, this is all living things. All living things can fit in one of three folders. The bacteria folder, the archaea folder, and the eukaryote folder. And they all have some kind of common ancestor there, according to evolutionists. We're going to look at a guy who's a member of this group, archaea. Very, very simple, though. One-celled organism. Really fuzzy picture, but when you're as small as he is, hard to get a good one. Notice he's sort of shaped like a oval, and it has a tail on it. That tail is important. This thing can swim. And it swims in response to light. Some light is good light, and some light's bad light, just like you. You can't stay in the wrong kind of light, you get burned, and that's not healthy for you. Then you spend the rest of your days fighting skin cancer in Florida, right? Because that light's not good for you. Neither it is for this guy. So what this guy does when there's no stimulus around, when there's no light around, it just sort of swims around randomly. And the way it does, these things are programmed to swim in a straight line, and then every so often they stop swimming and they just sort of tumble randomly in space. Like that, just sort of tumble. And they just start swimming, and whatever direction they're pointing, that's where they go. And that's just sort of what they do. Sort of like you feel at a party where you don't know anybody. You just sort of meander around, bouncing nowhere. Right? Just sort of going around. But when light is present, it still runs straight and then tumbles, but it changes the pattern. And it looks like this. It may start here at the bottom, and down here at the bottom is harmful light. Maybe this is good light. And it's going to move toward the good light. And the way it does it is it can sense this is harmful light, and it's going to swim longer. As long as it can tell it's swimming away from something bad, it's going to swim longer. This is going to stop and tumble like it does right at that point. I am really shaky. Look at that. Too much sugar or something. And it's going to tumble, and it's going to start swimming. And if it starts swimming back towards the harmful, see, like that line is going this direction? If it can tell it's going to bad light again, it's going to tumble faster because it's going the wrong direction. And here it goes again. Doesn't tumble very long, but here's another long one because it's going in a good direction. Short tumble, a little bit short, another long one, another long one. So eventually this bacteria gets into a happy place and it avoids the dangerous stuff. Got it? To be sensitive to light, it has to do something like this. Otherwise, who cares? It has to have some kind of benefit. And the fact is, this is a real benefit to this bacteria. To this archaea, to this cell, called a cell. Because it lets it survive longer. You with me? All right, I know on Wednesday nights, we're tired. We've been at school, we've been working, and frankly, to hear a technical talk on a Wednesday night, it's hard. So I'm trying to try to keep it really simple. As simple as I can. I'm going to mention three main proteins. The first is called retinol. All right, retinol. It has one job. I'll tell you what it is in just a second. Retinol. The second main protein has a long name, but we'll just make it simple. It's called sensory rhodopsin 2. Sounds fun. And then there's a third protein. We'll just call it HTR. Good enough. Good? I'm going to tell you what these three proteins do. I'll mention some other smaller ones along the way, but just remember these three, and that'll be good enough, because this is, I think, impressive enough to make the point. These proteins are all buried in the membrane of this cell. All cells have a membrane, which itself, by the way, is tremendously cool and complex. And it has to be the way it is for all those things to work. So here's the cell membrane. And it has the consistency of olive oil, basically, a cell membrane does. It's pretty fairly delicate. But you can sandwich all kinds of stuff in there. The cell membrane is the outside of the cell. It's like the leather on the basketball. And so anything coming in or out of the cell has to go through that cell membrane. And as thin and small as it is, it's really good at controlling what comes in and out. But you can stick stuff in it, like proteins. This is a protein here and there, and those are some sugars and stuff sticking off of it. But you can plug proteins in it. These three proteins are plugged in the membrane of this cell. You with me? So what happens is this. Make sure I start with what I want to start with. This is retinol. This is retinol's job. It reacts to light. That's all its job is. It reacts to light. Retinol looks like this. This is like stick figures for chemists. That's what this is. It doesn't really look like a stick. It's very, very complex. It's a protein. And proteins are very complex three-dimensional structures with a very specific three-dimensional shape. If that shape's wrong, that protein doesn't work. And it's not going to do its job. But you don't want to draw that. You want to draw a stick figure. When there's no light around, this is what it looks like. It's got a little zigzag in the tail. But when the right kind of light hits it, it tweaks. It pivots. And it pivots right there at that spot. That happens to be a carbon atom. And it's going to spin. And right there at that little spot, it just pivots down. See the difference in the picture? It's like holding your fist like this. And they hit you with light. You put it like that. That's what retinol does. Simple enough. So a photon of light hits it, and it, that's what it does. That's the science word for it. It right there. And that's its job. You done with retinol? That's its job. Get hit by light and wave the hand. Retinol, though, doesn't sit there by itself in the cell membrane. It's actually in the middle of a larger protein. Anybody know the name of that second protein? You remember it? Sensory rhodopsin 2. Awesome. Sensory rhodopsin 2 is a pretty large protein. And in this picture, you can see retinol right here. See that little pink thing? Right, that's retinol. It sits right in the middle at a very specific place, by the way. It has to be connected to exactly the right piece. The sensory rhodopsin 2 is this great big protein, and it zigzags up and down through that membrane of the cell. Here's one end of it here, and it goes up and then loops down, and it loops back again here and here, and then back here in the background, there's another loop and up. So it zigzags 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. So it zigzags up inside and down the cell. And here's the outside end. Well, what's it doing there? What's it doing? Well, retinol can do this all day, and who cares? Light hits it, and something has to reset, then hits it, and so what? Sensory rhodopsin 2 helps the cell know that retinol is up there flapping around. It helps communicate it. Have you ever been in a situation where maybe people are holding hands and one person squeezes one person's hand, and they squeeze the hand of the person next to them, they squeeze the hand of the person next to them? You know what I'm talking about? That kind of, maybe you've never done that, but you get the idea, right? You send a signal by a little domino effect. That's what cells do. Retinol is the first domino. And then it swings that arm down, it affects sensory rhodopsin too, because they're connected together. And it changes sensory rhodopsin's shape as well. It changes it very specifically. And sensory rhodopsin goes through a whole cycle of shape changes. And of course, they've named all these things. And so you start here, and it goes to something called K510, and L495, and an M1, and an M2, and an O5 something, and they're back. And it runs through this cycle. And it's this protein just doing this. That's what it does. And all in milliseconds. Right? This first step, microseconds. There's 1 microsecond, 30 microseconds, 2 milliseconds. And this is the sum. How long total does it take to go through this cycle? So in less than half a second, it's done with this cycle. Every molecule of sensory rhodopsin runs through this cycle. M2 is where it sends the signal. And specifically, what happens is it connects to another domino, another protein. So that's 2 proteins so far. You got it? Retinol responds to light and changes its shape. Because it's sandwiched inside this other protein, it makes that protein change its shape in a very specific way. All right, third one, and we're done. Mostly. And that's this protein called HTR. HTR is also stuck in the membrane here, and it has a little piece wagging way deep down inside the cell. That's important, because that's how it's going to tell the cell, hey, look, something's happening up here. HTR and sensory rhodopsin sit right next to each other, like this. This is sensory rhodopsin in red. There's 2 of them, 1 there, 1 there. And this is the HTR protein in green. It has 2 loops in it. Here's 1, and there's 2. And they sit right next to each other. Good? Now take that picture. I'm just going to show you another picture because it's interesting. And spin it. Just spin it 90 degrees. You're going to look down this tube right here. You're going to look down the tubes, and it looks like this. So there's sensory rhodopsin there and there. And then here's 1 piece of HTR. And here's a 2nd piece of HTR. Cool? See how close they are? Right in here? This little loop is right next. This one, they name all these things. This is called TM2. That's called G. Those two are really close. The same thing over here, TM2 and G. Those two things communicate. And they communicate very specifically with each other. In fact, just because you're going to remember this, TM2, when retinol spins, retinol, I don't know if you can see it, it's a little sort of brown molecule right there. When it changes its shape because it got hit by light, it makes sensory rhodopsin change its shape. And G interacts with TM2 and makes that thing spin clockwise 15 degrees precisely and tilt. What difference does that make? Well, the difference it makes is that there's this big tail wagging down inside the cell. And when that stuff is tilting up here, it makes that tail wag inside the cell. And it's like a flag waving and saying, hey, there's light up here. And that's going to start another bunch of dominoes inside the cell moving. Pretty amazing, right? How did vision begin? A single cell organism developed sensitivity to light. That's how it began. Well, that's pretty simple to say, isn't it? Anybody can say that. But you get down to where life works, and life works with chemistry. That's what makes life happen. And if you're going to explain it, you got to explain how the chemistry happened. And this is the tiddlywinks version of photosensitivity in single-cell organisms. And you notice what has to be in place and where it has to be in place and how precisely it has to be in place. And all those things have to be built. And we haven't begun to talk about how you even build a protein in the first place. And you got to stick it in the right place to begin with. Anybody can say that. Something else entirely to do it. So now I'll just give you a quick run through of the other dominoes in the cell. And we're done with the technical stuff. Here's light. There's sensory rhodopsin 2, retinol sandwiched in there. There's HTR. So we just went through how all those things sort of talk to each other. When HTR gets signaled, It wiggles a tail down here, and it triggers a protein called CHEW to help it talk to a protein called CHEA. And it takes a P off of another molecule and sticks it on the A. So now it's CHEA with a P on it. That P is phosphate, by the way. Many times when a cell is talking to itself, it does so by sticking phosphates, one thing to another. If I took a sticky note and stuck it on you, and then you took it and stuck it on somebody else, that's what they're doing. Just shoot, okay, and you stick it on them, right? That's how that works. And that's how phosphate works inside cells often. And so CHEA now becomes CHEA with a P on it. It's going to take that phosphate, and it's going to stick it onto CHEY. CHEY takes the phosphate and sticks it on the switch of the flagella, the little tail that spins. CHEY communicates with that. And then that motor switch causes the cell tumbling to change. It's either going to keep it tumbling or it's going to make it stop tumbling because it's going the wrong direction. Crazy, isn't it? But you're not done. Because all this has to be reset. And so there's other pieces in here. CHEZ, we think, helps pull that P off of CHEY and make it just regular old CHEY again. It also takes the P and gives it to CHEB. CHEB with a P on it is going to go back to HTR and help slow it down. So that this communication doesn't overrun itself, you got to slow it down. But you want to start it again, and there's another protein called CHER that does the opposite of CHEP and sort of turns HTR on again. How did vision begin? Simple. It's easy. A single cell organism developed the ability to detect light. You see what that takes? And it's just intellectually dishonest to understand that kind of complexity and then demand that nobody question the Darwinian explanation of the human eye or vision at all. You're not even allowed to challenge it. That is just intellectually, I believe, dishonest. So that's photosensitivity in a very quick nutshell in bacteria and other single-cell organisms. But as I mentioned, in addition to all that, you got to reset the entire system. Something has to take retinol's arm and put it back where it was. You got to take that piece that was turned 15 degrees and tilted, tilt it back, and spin it 15 degrees back where it came from. All that has to be adjusted. And for the system to work, all these pieces have to be in place. You have to integrate all of these signals. It's not just light that these things respond to. They respond to salt content, acidity, and alkalinity, all kinds of stuff. And all those signals are coming in. The proteins have to target the right molecule. You have to target the flagella, not something else. The proteins have to be in the right location. You take retinol and stick it somewhere else, it can wag its little hand all day, and it's not going to be of any benefit because it's in the wrong place. All that has to happen for that to work, and all the proteins must be present for this whole system to work. And so anybody can say simply, some simple cells developed light-sensitive spots in the membrane that could detect the presence of light. That's easy to say, and it's easy to write. But you get down the nitty-gritty of how vision works, how light sensitivity in a single-cell organism works, and you've got a lot more explaining to do. Dawkins, in his book, says, in this discussion of human vision, after all, remember, half an eye is better than no eye. Is that right? If I take half your eye, you're going to be very happy with that? Half vision is better than no vision. But half an eye is probably not worth anything. And the problem has always been, with the Darwinian explanation of things, is how do you maintain a functional system where you take a human eye and make it a little less imperfect and a little less imperfect, and you do that 10,000 times. Who says it's functional all those 10,000 times? Says who? And on what basis of evidence can you show that? And of course you can't. That's entirely faith-based. But that's the argument we have. gradualism sounds easy until you know how complex the simple is. Before the bells start ringing, I want to share something with you. Admittedly, in Darwin's day, biology was far, far simpler than it is in our day. Our understanding, no one understood the complexity of a cell. I mean, nothing close to it in Darwin's day. It was much, much simpler. I want to illustrate this. This is a reprint of a textbook that a friend gave to me, who's a textbook sales rep, I think from the 20s. This was the first biology, high school biology textbook published by this company back in the 20s. I would just want to read you what this high school textbook says about the cell in the 1920s. It's not technical, so don't, like, I see that every day. Don't do that. You can stay with this. Because they didn't know it was this technical. I just want to share this with you. This is what they say about the cell. Let me find it. All right, this is going to talk about what's inside the cell. You look inside the cell and it looks soupy. It's really liquidy and watery. And they say it's named protoplasm. Protoplasm is alive. And in truth, the only living substance. We do not know what life is, but we do know that as long as life exists in plants or animals, their protoplasm is active. When it ceases to act, death is the result. So if you look at a living cell, you can see the inside of the cell moving around. And when that stuff stops moving, well, the cell's dead. And so what is life? Well, we don't know, but whatever that goo is in a cell we call protoplasm, that's alive. No, it's not, folks. It's water with a bunch of chemicals in it. That's not alive. That's what they thought. Let me tell you what they thought was in a cell. It is a jelly-like substance composed of, and this is the list, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, and phosphorus. That's what's in a cell. And then on the next page, you have two paragraphs about saying what cells are and some sketches of different types of cells, a muscle cell and a nerve cell. And that's what they thought a cell was. And this is 50 years after Darwin published, 60 years after Darwin published Origin of Species. That's 1920s. This book is my graduate cell biology textbook. You take an entire graduate course on the cell. Largest textbook I ever had to buy. The new edition, they had to take the final chapters out and stick them on DVD because students were griping the book was so big you couldn't carry it anywhere. Understand why? Because the cell is no simple thing. It is a more complicated and profoundly complex thing than we have ever developed. And I'm talking about the simple cells. This is what a cell is. That's what it takes. And that's every chapter in this book you can take a graduate course on. You could write multiple doctoral theses on every chapter in the book. It is astounding how complex it is. And so the simple argument, how can we continue to make the simple argument that, well, we know where it all came from. It just happened. I think it's the same idea that we find in Mark chapter 8. I want to read these verses with you. We haven't read any. Let's read these. Mark chapter 8, beginning in verse 15. Mark chapter 8, verse 15. Then he charged them, saying, take heed. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have no bread. But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said to him, 12. Also, when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? And they said, 7. So he said to them, how is it you do not understand? It's not uncommon for us to see, but not see anything. For God to make himself seen, and we just miss him. not because the evidence isn't there, not because it hasn't been repeatedly presented to us, but because there's something in the heart that won't allow the evidence to be seen. That's the danger. And that's the danger of Darwinism. That people will take it, and they take it with such absolute faith that they won't see anything else. And they'll see 10,000 imagined steps between a human eye and some proposed first light-sensitive cell. But they won't see the tremendous complexity of what it takes to make that first cell to begin with. God is in sight. He's in sight in when we understand how light sensitivity works. And he's in sight because he simply has made himself known to us. And you could turn to practically any page in the college biochemistry textbook and find systems like the one we've seen here. In every living organism, for all kinds of systems, there's thousands of them. And every day we're learning more and more about how these systems work. It's always more complicated than we think. It's always more involved than we think. And we need to be careful, wherever we are in our thought of God's existence or not, that we don't miss what's right before us. Because God is in sight. Thank you very much for your attention tonight.